This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. He'll have the latest on the budget chaos that continues at the Capitol with the fiscal cliff now in the offing, just over a month away. June 30th is not so far in the distance. Also, Manuel Martinez, the world-famous clothier, named three times by the World Congress the best in the world at what he does. We'll have the latest on fashion, both locally and around the world. And we'll take a look at summer fashion. I'm looking at Manuel right now, and he is impeccably groomed and dressed for the occasion. And Dr. Jacques Berlinerblau will discuss the complex legacy of author Philip Roth, who died at the age of 85 this week. Man who left quite a legacy as a National Book Award winner and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming in just a bit, we'll hear from the renowned tailor, Manuel Martinez, who is sartorially splendid today as we prepare for a discussion about summer fashion and more. But at the Capitol, right now, their focus is not on fashion, it's on money. The fiscal cliff is in the offing, and Mark Ballard is there. And before we get to what's going on at the state capitol, the governor of Louisiana yesterday made a pit stop at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center as the final rites for Billy Cannon were held, LSU's only Heisman Trophy winner, dead at 80 years old. He died Sunday, and what a long and illustrious and occasionally controversial life he led. And Mark Ballard, it's impossible to have lived in this community for many years, as you and I have, without having some impression and exposure to the great Billy Cannon.
Yeah, I don't think there's a person that lives in this community or has lived here for any time that has not seen the Halloween night run, and has put Billy Cannon up as one of the icons of LSU football.
Well,
then there was also some of, his downfall with the counterfeit money has also got to be a part of that memory as well.
Yeah, that is a part of his life that he did not shy away from, and the obits that have been nationally notable, including the one in the New York Times, mentions the counterfeiting caper. But he came back from that, and America loves, if nothing more than a story about redemption, and Billy Cannon had lots of that. And when he returned to Baton Rouge 30 years ago or so after serving his time, he made quite an impression and spent many years as the dentist at Angola, the nation's largest maximum security prison. And he died not so far from there at his home in St. Francisville Sunday. And a stirring eulogy yesterday by Warren Rapp, his teammate, who's now 80 years old, looks fantastic, and knew Billy Cannon for well over 60 years. He played against him for 4 years in high school, and then with him for 4 years at Tigertown, and he said playing with him was a lot better than playing against him.
It was a remarkable team that came out of Estruma High School that then went on to LSU, or a lot of those members did, and won a national championship. So.
Yeah, it was a national championship that was fueled by athletes from Baton Rouge, Warren Rapp, Johnny Robinson, and, of course, the great Billy Cannon. Rabb and Robinson are still alive, and the 60th anniversary celebration of their championship, the last undefeated season for the Tigers, will be without the greatest player of them all, the Heisman Trophy winner from Philadelphia, Mississippi, who came to Baton Rouge in World War II with his dad, Harvey, who got a job at one of the plants, and that's how it began in Tigertown for Billy Ab Cannon, gone at 80 years old. Mark Ballard, the special session is ongoing. It has to end by June 4th, so we're, 11 days from the finish line, and there is still much uncertainty in special session number 6 under Governor Edwards. Yesterday, the story that is on the front page from Elizabeth Crisp, lawmakers begin to review tax proposals. Consensus on budget solutions still elusive. It is amazing that they go into these special sessions and they really don't have their act together. What is happening?
Well, I think there's a philosophical, base philosophical difference between enough of the House Republicans that can stop any taxes and the Democrats, and it basically boils down to sales taxes versus income taxes. And the Republicans seem to think that we can fix the whole thing by dealing with sales taxes, which they, you know, everybody does, buys things. And income taxes would be too much of a hit on the middle class. The Democrats counter by saying that these income tax proposals that they're pushing are not that going to be, will not be that much of a hit on the middle class, but the sales taxes that the Republicans are pushing would make the poor and low income, which is over half the state, end up paying the lion's share of state government out of their incomes. And that's where it is, and that was, that was the fight that started in 2016, and they still have come to no resolution on this. And I think they've actually hardened their positions, and I don't think that they're going to get anything done by June 4th.
Then what happens?
Well, then another special session. Remember that the real deadline is June 30th. We have to have a balanced budget going into July 1st, a balanced budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. So we have the time, basically the rest of June, to try to work out this problem.
So you're saying that we may have special session number 7?
Well, yeah, this is from the folks that I keep talking to, you know, the representatives and senators, that's kind of what they're thinking, is that we'll be going into another special session.
Well, this plan that is on the table, House Bill 11, would extend a half cent of the temporary sales tax, which expires at the end of next month. That would be $550 million. The governor says he's okay with that. Originally, he didn't want any sales tax extension, but now I think he has a dose of reality and realizes this is about the best he can accomplish. But it takes 70 votes in the House, and it only takes a few coalitions to thwart that. 70 votes means that if everybody shows up, you got to get 70 of 105. And actually, if everybody doesn't show up, you still got to get 70 votes.
Exactly.
So go ahead.
Well, part of what HB 11 does is it also strips away some of the exemptions that are on the sales tax. That's why that number can hit close to $500,000. There is a coalition in among the Republicans, about 23, 24 members, and if the Democrats vote as a block, and including the Black Caucus voting as a block, and if they can pull over 14, 15 moderate Republicans, and they have been able to do that in the past, then that part will be passed. What's really of concern for the Democrats is that that'll be part of it, but they're afraid that the Republicans then will, you know, wash their hands of it and then just cut from that point on, which, you know, we're looking at $150 to $200 million cuts, all of which will be coming out of health care and higher education. And they're saying, well, look, you know, if we give you this part, you need to give us something. And that's, I think, that's where the fight is right now.
What is the something?
Well, they're looking right now at rolling back this federal excise deduction, which Louisiana is one of only a couple of states that allow, and that is that the deductions that you take on your federal income tax, if it's over the standardized deduction on the federal income tax, you can take the part that's over the standardized deduction and take it off of your state income taxes. Now, the arguments for that is that it's only a small percentage of taxpayers in Louisiana who make enough money that can actually take that particular tax break, and that the federal tax break includes the state taxes that you pay, so that what you end up doing is you get to write off the state taxes on your state taxes, the state taxes that you paid the previous year on your state taxes this year. What has changed in this is that the Trump tax plan has increased the standardized deduction, so there won't be as many people who can take advantage of that federal itemized deduction. So that's something that they're looking forward to. They're also looking forward in making permanent some of the exemptions that they had temporarily put in that basically is tax breaks for corporations.
What is the process right now for the governor? Can he make deals? Can he threaten lawmakers? Does he have any leverage in trying to get those 70 votes?
Well, he's a governor of Louisiana, and so he does have extreme leverage. This governor, however, has not used a lot of that leverage and has been trying to win on the bully pulpit and has not really been able to articulate his vision that well on the bully pulpit, and he's hoping to persuade them that way. But, I mean, as a governor of Louisiana, there's plenty of things he could do that would be kind of forceful politics. But he hasn't done that yet. So I guess we're going to have to see how that all goes. Well, I think one of the things that he did was by vetoing the budget. And it's some people kind of think that it's sort of, a bold move, like, Cortez burning the ships when he got to Mexico and saying, there's no turning back. And others are saying, well, that was a needless provocation of the House Republicans. And I guess we'll see how that plays out as well.
And he opened the week by going to Lafayette, which is not generally good terrain for Democrats, speaking at UL, University of Louisiana Lafayette, and talking about cuts to higher education.
And I think, I don't know this, but I'm under the impression that that his political advisors are saying that, you are most unpopular in Acadiana. So, go into the lion's mouth and make your pitch there. And I think that played a large part in it. And then also underlying that was, this is the sixth session. We've done the same thing every single time, and he was maybe trying to mix it up a little bit rather.
Okay, we do have to roll, Mark, but thank you for your insights as always. We'll be calling again next week. Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And in studio is Manuel Martinez, the world-renowned tailor who calls Baton Rouge home. He came here by way of Tampico, Mexico, the year of 1984, and for the last 34 years he's been thrilling the masses with his designs, and we'll talk with him about what he's wearing today and what's hot for the summer. But three times named by the World Congress of Tailors, the best in the world was Manuel Martinez over the last 20 years in Venice, Paris, and Berlin. Competitions from the World Congress. Do you still participate in those?
No, not anymore, Jim. I sort of kind of gave that up.
You decided three is okay. Yes. After that, I mean, how many times can you win to make your point? But you're still doing the same thing.
I'm still doing the same thing. I'm still enjoying designing and making clothes. It's a beautiful, beautiful trade.
Well, you've been influencing men's fashion in Baton Rouge since 1984 and actually designed clothes for a few women. Custom suits, unique neckwear, and dapper shirt options. How would you describe the outfit you have on today?
But the fabric that I'm wearing today is a hybrid. It's a mixture of wool, linen, and silk. As it appears to be 100% linen, it's not. So it gives you that fresh, cool look, and it is in a beautiful blue, what I call a Newport blue, and I pair it with a tie that has blue tan, as well as a gingham blue shirt. So that all coordinates very well.
It looks good, and we'll have a photo of Manuel on our website when we part company today. But usually you wear colors that go well with your olive complexion, and that certainly does. But I could actually wear what you have on today with my complexion, couldn't I?
This is one of the blues that you can wear very, very well. Your warm complexion, the colors that you should be wearing should be more in the marine blues. This is not quite a marine blue, but it's a color you can get away with. Now, you are wearing the right tie, and you're wearing the right color shirt for your complexion. The suit's a little bit dark for you because, it's, again, your complexion is warm.
I would look better with a suit your color, right?
And with your blue eyes, it would just be striking.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're looking out for me. And through the years, I have occasionally gotten some clothes from Manuel Martinez. and once was actually clothed by him for a shoot for In Register. And I'm proud to say that last time I was there, you actually had me on the wall with Joe Biden, with Johnny Cochran, with Nick Saban. Nick Saban. Now, we've talked about this a few times in the past, but Nick Saban, as we know, didn't become Nick Saban until he came to Baton Rouge. When he came here, he was wearing no socks and turtlenecks, and he was one of those guys who looks good in anything. But you made him a fashion plate, Manuel Martinez.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the relationship I had with Nick, and regardless whether you like him or not, but he was a man that he listened to people that knew things more than he did. And one of the things that I know about it is clothes. And with our clothes, he made the best-dressed collegiate coach in America by the sports magazine, Sports Illustrated magazine, as well as he was mentioned in the Morning Advocate because of his clothes. So we got him out of those crew necks and those oversized coats that he was wearing back then.
Well, and he's looked good ever since. And, of course, when you win national titles, you even look better. And one of those fellows who always stood out died last week, Tom Wolfe. Actually, May 15th, he died, and the New York Times had him on his front page in one of his famous outfits. It says, "Bashed or an unabashed contrarian, he was almost as well known for his attire as his satire. He was instantly recognizable as he strolled down Madison Avenue, a tall, slender, blue-eyed, still boyish-looking man in his spotless three-piece vanilla suit, pinstripe silk shirt with starched white high collar, bright handkerchief peeking from his breast pocket, watch on a fob, faux spats, and white shoes. Once asked to describe his getup, Mr. Wolf replied brightly, neo-pretentious. He was not afraid to stand out in a crowd." And you're smiling. This guy was legendary in fashion circles, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And he did make a statement with his vanilla or cream color suits, and he wore them summer and winter. It didn't matter. During the winter, he wore his flannels, what he was calling the winter whites. But he was great for our business, and we hate to see him go. I wish more gentlemen would dress in this manner.
Now, would a guy like that look in place if he were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or would people be pointing and perhaps laughing?
Well, here in Baton Rouge during the summer, he would be right in place with the color of suits that he was wearing. During the winter, people perhaps would raise an eyebrow and say, "What is he doing?" But most people don't understand this. You can't wear white as long as it's a flannel, and they are called winter whites. And I do wear them often, not as a suit, but either as a blazer or trousers, and they look very nice during the winter.
Really? Well, my producer, one of our producers, Ali Baltazar, said one day when I wore a white shirt that I should never wear white after Labor Day. Is she wrong?
Well, white shirts you can wear anytime. Now, as far as suits, whether if they're linen or wool and it is white, you don't wear them before Easter and you don't wear them after Labor Day. So
okay.
She is right.
She is right.
Yes.
Right, as she usually is. 877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Manuel Martinez has people come from all over the country to be fitted by him. And it's like going to a doctor's office. He's so meticulous. You have to take your shirt off, and he gets all those precise measurements. Next time, he said he's going to bring my measurements through the years, the times I've gone there, and I'd like to know how I've changed. People do change through the years, so that means you got repeat customers because, especially in Baton Rouge, they're usually getting a little heavier around the midsection, right? And so they need to come back.
Do you really want to be embarrassed? I mean, when I first met you in 2005, you were a lean, mean machine.
Aren't I still a lean, mean machine?
You know, gravity has a funny way of showing when we age.
I thought I still look pretty good, man.
You still look good. but if you're game, I'm game. I will bring your measurements.
Yeah, I want you to do that.
Yes.
But when I buy clothes off the rack, the clothes today are made for heavy guys, heavier than I am, so it's kind of hard to find things sometimes.
In your case, it would be, but, you know, the skinny suits which
I'm not skinny, but I'm not fat either.
But you're wearing the skinny, what is called the skinny suit. You see the skinny lapels that you're wearing,
yeah,
today. And that is fine. Fashion is fine for the young people, but once you get to be a certain age, everybody should dress their age.
Really?
Yes.
You're saying that this suit is worn out as welcome?
No. It's still in fashion. Perhaps in a year or so, they moving towards wider lapels.
So I should kind of put it into retirement soon?
Well, just wait about another 6 months.
You have wide lapels.
Right.
And I heard that the first suit you designed for Nick Saban, he was furious. He saw those lapels, and he said, Manuel, I'm a football coach. I'm not an entertainer. You got to make me another suit.
That's right.
Did he tell you that?
But not exactly that way, but that was the suit that
probably a few other words mixed in with it.
No, he was always a gentleman with me, very very diplomatic. That was the suit that I made for him to go to the White House when they won the championship, and they gave me carte blanche. Said, "You design it. I'm going to meet with the most powerful man in the world, and I'm going to represent the number one university in the world, and I want you to design a suit as such." So I did.
Yeah, and he ended up wearing the suit reluctantly. And then I saw him everywhere. He started overwearing that suit. You don't want to wear the same suit everywhere. I remember Lonnie Anderson, Burt Reynolds said she broke him because she would never wear the same thing twice. She says, "I'm a star." But Saban was wearing that suit everywhere he went.
Well, he did wear it several times. But one person I have to thank is his wife, Terry. God bless her. She's the one that made it put him on. And I was told by his assistant, J.O., who still works with Coach O at LSU, that they never had so many calls. And it wasn't about the championship, but it was about the suit that he was wearing in the White House. And all favorite calls. So Nick, after that, enjoy wearing the suit.
Okay. 877-217-5757 for Manuel Martinez. Three times named best in the world at what he does. Back after the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. Manuel Martinez is in the house. Three times named best in the world by the World Congress of Tailors for his designs of suits for men. 2001 in Paris, 2003 in Venice, and 2005 in Berlin. And now he says he has retired from that competition. He lets other people win now. But he's based right here in Baton Rouge, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, let's face it, is not a fashion mecca. What's the greatest city in the world for fashion right now for men?
I would say Milan. Milan, New York, London, those three cities are always in fashion.
New York. Still sets the pace.
New York, yes, it still sets the pace in this country, and Milan. They're very close, Milan and New York.
All right. Now, this is, in all the years we've talked, one of the most unusual questions I've gotten from a listener, but it's certainly a pertinent one. Rona says, for funerals, what is the appropriate way to dress a corpse?
Well, depending on the individual. Of course, a dark suit is always very appropriate. But if the individual had a good life and he enjoyed wearing bright colors, why not?
Yeah.
It's a celebration of life.
Yeah, you would want him to dress the way he was most comfortable.
The way he was most comfortable.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you do some female attire as well. But when women come in, do they usually get suits from you?
Basically, that's what we do for them.
You do suits.
Suits.
So you're dressing them in a nice suit, but right. It would be something that a man could wear as well.
Not necessarily. No. Well, I mean, if you're talking about the color of the fabric, yes.
All right. But there is a distinction.
Yes.
Okay. What about Casual Friday? This is something that invariably crops up. You've had this war on Casual Friday for some time. You don't think it's a very good idea. You think it's been a desecration of our culture. Why?
But, you know, when you relax your standards, you relax in every single form of shape. Your services, I think also some of the sexual harassment suits are due to people being more relaxed by the way they dress. And that may have some reflection into that.
How people behave.
How people behave. Your behavior is completely different. You put an individual in a suit, and he tends to behave different. Michael Douglas was asked one time, he said, how can you go from comedy to seriousness to crime movies and so on? He said, it's all in the wardrobe.
Really? And your buddy, Gene Vannetti? Is that
Benanzi. Yes, Jim Benanzi.
Yeah, he was on this show, and I hope Michael Douglas wasn't listening that day because he commented that Michael's not nearly as tall as he projects on the big screen. And he looks massive on the screen, but he's not a big man. But in Wall Street, he looked fabulous, and of course he was that evil character Gordon Gekko, but he fit the part, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did fit the part, and they made some beautiful clothes for Michael Douglas for that movie, Wall Street.
Yeah. So if you were designing somebody's clothes for this particular time and this particular place, summer in Baton Rouge, what would go well today for summer fashion in our community?
When in our community, our classics are the seersuckers. I mean, I don't wear the seersuckers. I'd rather wear the woolen linen that I'm wearing today. Also, people here wear several of the cotton suits as well. But what you got to remember is just to dress on lighter colors instead of darker colors. Your light grays do very well to go to the office. Medium chaser blues do very well to go to the office. And the shirt should be pastels.
All right. Marion says the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, has picked up his game as far as fashion. Is he getting any help, Manuel?
Well, I don't know if he's fashion, but definitely his style has changed. You know, fashion comes and goes, but he's wearing suits that I think he could be wearing for the next 5 years because of the way they were made for him. The proportions are right. No wide lapels, no skinny lapels, medium. The fit is not a fit that is overly fitted, but it does make him look a little bit more masculine. It makes him look a little slender. And so I think the proportions are right.
Well, Rona's second question is whether he's seeing you, or is the governor, is he a patron?
Well, I mean, I can't answer those questions, you know, Taylor Klein.
Really, the Taylor Klein privilege? I think that might be a yes. But anyway, here's another question saying Donald Trump needs some help with suits that are fitting him well. He's a big man, and it looks like he's gotten bigger. I would imagine he has tailors working his beat regularly, but what do you think of his attire?
Well, Donald Trump buys very expensive suits. He does buy Brioni. One of my mentors years ago, about 10 or 15 years ago, used to make his clothes, but Donald didn't have the patience, and he still doesn't have the patience to go have a custom-made suit. So therefore, he just buys them off the rack. And a lot of times, they just send them to him, and he wears them as they are.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and those ties.
They're a little too long.
But they go down too far.
Yes. The ties should not go below the top of the belt.
Well, in your case, you've often said it's not just the suit, but it's the hair, the shoes, and your physical build. You were commenting about these measurements, but you obviously have stayed in shape. That doesn't come by osmosis. You work at it. Let's start with the hair, though. You don't sell hair products at Manuel Martinez
No.
Fine Clothiers, but somebody's doing your hair.
Well, I was blessed with good genes.
Don't give me that. Somebody's doing your hair, Manuel.
Yes. Matter of fact, the name of the lady does my hair is Ann at Halpin's Beauty Shop on Lapdale and Jefferson.
Really? And how often do you go?
Ann James has been doing my hair, I don't know, since 1990.
You go once a week?
No, once a week. No, once every 3 weeks.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I'm doing now.
877-217-5757. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Manuel Martinez. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Tim. I just remembering one of my favorite places to shop for men's clothing was the clothing department at Maison Blanche when it was downtown. They just had such good taste in their in fact, I have 4 shirts that I still wear that have, you know, they look brand new, and that's how good they were when I got them. So I think, you know, that one thing about quality of clothing that, and stuff that looks good will stay looking good.
All right. Shirts, should they be 100% cotton?
I prefer 100% cotton because they breathe, especially here as warm as it is here in Louisiana, and they feel better against your skin. For some reason today, that the introduction to non-wrinkle shirts have made a big dent in the market. Those particular shirts, when you after three or four launders, they lose some of those chemicals, they get treated, and the jury is still out where those chemicals eventually is going to be harmful to the individual that wears those wrinkle-free shirts.
All right. Another listener asked, when shirts are taken to the laundry, a laundromat, or cleaners, should they be starched?
I recommend not to starch your shirts because, number one, they will last you less, two, they wrinkle faster, and three, if it's a very nice shirt, a very fine shirt, after three or four times that somebody starts the shirts, they feel like sandpaper. Mm-hmm. So don't starch them. You want them to last longer, and you want them to feel better.
You have scolded me through the years for not wearing collar stays, and I now have collar stays, and I did wear one of my Manuel Martinez shirts. How important is it to have a collar stay?
When you're wearing a tie, it's very important, so to keep the collar laying properly around your neck. And if you don't wear them, the collar just doesn't look quite right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned that you stay in shape, but I'm sure a lot of people you work with, we do live in Louisiana, probably need a little work in that area. I doubt that you're scolding your clients, but what can you do to make them look better if they don't look so good when they take off their shirts?
Well, that's the beauty of what I do. You have to be more of an artist. You have to be more than an artist. This is not a science. Tailoring is not a science. So if the gentleman has not an abdomen, by working the canvas and putting darts on the front, we can make them look like they have a small waist. And we will try to build his chest for him to look more masculine. And the button placement is very important on a gentleman with an abdomen. If you put it too low, the abdomen is going to protrude above the button, and it's not going to be a pretty picture. So if you put it too high, then it's going to protrude at the bottom. So you have to know what you're doing. You have to place it at the right place.
Now, I've told you this. I don't know if you believe me, but when I go buy clothes at Stein Mart, it's 32 waist. I know my waist really is. Now, you see, you're laughing, but 32. So how much of a difference is it between what you buy off the rack and what the real number is?
I see you still believe in Santa Claus. Several years ago, the ready-mades came up with this idea to mark all the sizes down. But in actuality, if you measure them, they were two sizes up. So if you buy a pair of jeans, 32, you're really 34. You're really 34.
Or more, maybe.
Or 34 or more in some cases. So they don't measure accurately.
But when you're measuring people and you say, like, Jim, you're 35, 34 and a half, and I say, no, I'm 32. I know I'm 32. And do you have trouble convincing people that?
Well, I don't have to convince them. I just say I'm going to make you the trousers the way that
I bet you hide the number from them, don't you?
Well, it depends, because a lot of gentlemen are sensitive, and a lot of people are sensitive to their weight, and I can understand that.
Well, next time you're on the show, I want you to bring my measurements, and we'll even update them so you can say how I've changed since 2005. Since 2005, and that'll encourage me to get in tip-top shape when next time I go to Manuel Martinez for some clothing advice, and perhaps even buy one of his fine shirts, one of which I'm wearing today. This was lasted about 3 years too. Looks pretty good, doesn't it?
Still looks new.
And I've probably worn it at least once, twice a month during that time. We'll have a few more minutes with Manuel. 877-217-5757. We're back after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Dr. Jacques Berliner-Blau. He's been with us before, and he is an authority on the work of Philip Roth, the great novelist who died a few days ago. He was 85 years old, one of the best American writers of his time or any time. But we're wrapping it up with Manuel Martinez, the fine clothier from Baton Rouge, who three times has been named best in the world by the World Congress of Tailors. And were commenting on how precise it is when, and I'm sure this is true in other places too, but I know Manuel, he's, when he's at his shop, he's got that measuring tape around his neck all the time. And when you're measuring somebody, another good question from a listener, can you tell sometimes if they have some health issues?
Yes, one of the health issues I can detect is back problems. If a gentleman or a lady has one hip shorter than the other one, eventually it's going to create a back problem. And when it's more than a half an inch, then you better be serious. It's going to create a back problem.
I noticed when I went, you told me I had one arm a little shorter than the other. And you may not remember it, but I now notice it. So I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. But what about, you know, you measure the chest and you measure the waist. What should be the difference? Because the people have said, you know, if you've got a huge waist as opposed to your chest, you got problems. That's a dead ringer for heart disease. So what should be the difference between those two?
Well, so that you know that the ready-made suits are made in a 6-inch drop, meaning, for example, if your chest is 40, your waist should be 34.
Mm-hmm.
So six inches,
that's the norm.
That's the norm.
But some people are, let's face it, some people have waists larger than their chests.
Yes. And those folks, you know, they need help when getting their clothes made, mm-hmm. and they need to come to somebody that knows how to make clothes.
All right, and then there are others who have nice physiques, and they have that L shape, and those. It's hard to find clothes when you're well built too.
Yeah, well, if you're an athlete, especially if you're an athlete, then you're definitely going to have a hard time trying to find clothes because you're not proportional. Your biceps are much lighter than your proportion of your chest. Sometimes their necks, their waist is small, their thighs are large. The buttocks are large, so it's just not a proportional thing. So they have to have clothes made.
All right, quickly, and I promoted the show by saying you were going to do this, and the listener says don't let him get away without naming some of the best dressed people. One local, one national.
One local. One local, Alton Ashy. One.
The lobbyist.
Yes, the lobbyist, Alton Ashy.
Well, most people don't know. I know him, and he's a well-dressed guy. But okay, is he well-dressed?
He's got his own proper style, his own signature, and whether you like what he wears or not, but the man has his own style.
He's got style.
He's got a style.
Okay, and nationally?
Well, one national right now that comes to my mind, and there's several of them, but I think that George Clooney, the actor, dresses well.
Yeah, he's a classic guy.
Yeah, he's dressed very well.
Very classic guy.
Yes.
But he's also a good-looking guy. It always helps.
Well, that helps.
Okay. Thank you, Manuel Martinez.
Thank you.
Let's do it again soon.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jim.
We're joined now by Dr. Jacques Berliner-Blau. He is the director of the Center for Jewish Civilization and chair in Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University. He's been with us before, and his latest concern is about the legacy of Philip Roth, one of the great writers of any time, who has a body of work that is immense and will last longer than anybody hearing the words uttered on this show. But you have a concern, Jacques, I believe, about Roth's legacy being largely focused upon his writing about sexuality, and you say there was much more to him than this. Why will people perhaps be focused on works like Portnoy's Complaint, which was a fine work and what caused him to burst onto the worldwide scene, and not focus on some of the more substantial writing he did along the way?
Great question. Hi, Jim. Hi, Louisiana. I think with Roth, one of the major questions we have to deal with is the moment that we're in right now. And the Me Too moment is taking a very hard and, I think, justified look at a lot of things that passed for normal in the past. So I often wonder if the salacious content, the kind of very sexed-up writing from a very, very masculinist perspective that we find in a lot of Roth's work, I sometimes wonder if this is going to sell or if it is going to be acceptable in the current intellectual environment in the United States.
Why are we hung up on this?
Well, it's funny because Roth is the type of writer who hates hang-ups. He hates sanctimony. He hates Puritanism. He hates mass hysteria. And I think what Philip Roth would have thought about the present moment is that it is a moment of mass hysteria. Now, this doesn't mean that Philip Roth is correct. A lot of his fiction can be dubbed misogynistic. It doesn't mean Roth is a misogynist. That's a different question. But a lot of what he writes about is male erotic desire run amok. So for many of my students at Georgetown University, for example, reading this, they're perplexed by it, and some of them are angered and shocked and stunned, and they don't want to read it anymore. And they're not the minority. That's what's most interesting. Having taught Roth for a quarter century, that type of student was in the minority. Now, these types of students that read this type of material and are very, very triggered, to use the term, they're becoming a larger cohort.
Is it equally perhaps offensive to both men and women, or is it more so with women who find his work to be over the top?
It's a little bit more with women, but you will find men that find the work to be problematic for them. With that said, there are always students that love it, that adore Roth, that can't get enough of Roth. There are feminists that love Roth. It's just there's certain aspects of his fiction, and I often believe those aren't the central aspects of his fiction, that might be threatening his longevity. And that's the question I've been thinking about over the last year or so, as my students start to change, as I get older, mm-hmm. and as this new generation comes into place.
Today in the New York Times, there's a column from Sam Lipsyte, who is the chairman of the writing program at Columbia. He says Roth explored ugly territory, but few have done so with such depth. When somebody is writing about characters who are misbehaving, does it necessarily mean that they have an experience of misbehaving themselves?
The stock answer is no, all right? But Roth is special, and I'll explain why in a moment for your listeners that might not know all of Roth's work, right? So we, as professors of literature, like to erect a firewall between the author and what the author creates. Mistake number one is to assume that an author is his or her characters. This is what makes Roth really, really tricky. Much of Roth's work from 1974 forward has been obsessed with blurring the line between the central protagonist in his novels and the author of Flesh and Blood named Philip Roth. And there's no avoiding this accusation with Roth. It's what makes his work so charming, I think, in that he creates these alter egos and doppelgangers that appear to be Philip Roth, or they appear to resemble Philip Roth in so many ways that one starts to wonder, is Roth writing autobiographically in some form or another? This is why the question is very, very complicated with this particular writer.
He was married twice, but both times short marriages of 4 years, the last to the well-known actress Claire Bloom, who did not speak well of him after the breakup. It's fair to say that some of the issues that he expresses in his novels, he experienced them in his own life, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he was actually married more than two times. Claire Bloom, in that novel, Leaving a Doll's House, really made some stunning accusations about Roth the man. Now, what we in the Roth industry know about Roth the man is few writers guarded their privacy more assiduously than Philip Roth. And what I've been arguing in my work on Roth is we actually don't know who he is and what he was like in private. And what makes it peculiar is it seems like he's always telling us in his fiction. So much of his fiction centers around a protagonist who appears to be Philip Roth. And I think it's a misdirection. It's a form of dissimulation where he's actually lying to readers. So the big question is, who is this guy? So the next move is to biography. We need credible, responsible, critical biographers to tell us about the private Philip Roth. But you're absolutely correct, Jim. What we heard from Claire Bloom was not promising in any way, shape, or form.
What's your favorite Roth work?
So I'm obviously an expert on this, so I'll give you some counterintuitive selections. My favorite Roth work is not Portnoy's complaint. I want to be very clear about that. People don't realize that Portnoy's complaint, which is his best-selling work, is actually a kind of mishmash of four other projects that he sort of glued together brilliantly. So it's not that one. My favorite Roth work is the 1979 The Ghostwriter, followed by the 1986 The Counterlife. I think those are two very, very special and unique works of American fiction.
Well, thank you. Jacques Berliner Blau, the chair of the Jewish Civilization Program at Georgetown University. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Thanks for listening.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.